We can get started. I'd like to welcome everybody back to another episode of Save for the Blind podcast. On this episode, you have Carson Odegaard, your normal co-host. Jeff Smith is out on vacation, and our guest today is Chad Santier, CWA Director of Wetlands Programs, and we're going to be talking about all things Southern California wetlands specifically right now, and hopefully by the end of the podcast, we'll get into some Southern California fundraising efforts that we are starting up. So Chad, I wanted to welcome you onto the podcast and excited to have you talk about what's going on down in SoCal.
Thanks, Carson. Glad you guys have me on to kind of give some idea to the Southern California folks that CWA is giving them some love.
Yeah, we've definitely been given a lot more love on Facebook. We've seemed to neglected that area in the past, and a lot of people kind of look over it. And now we're making a lot of social posts, but I think we're obviously doing more than what we're just showing there. And then we can talk about the detail of some of the stuff we're posting. So I'll kind of let you dive into what's been going on in the past, what we're doing now, and kind of where it's going in the future.
For sure. Probably one of the neatest things about Southern California is I kind of grew up down there. So I had quite a stint down there. First time I ever was went hunting was out in the Imperial Valley hunting dove with my father and get to experience the heat of September and the massive amount of birds that are down there. So I always had a longstanding interest in the area. Probably back in CWA, really our first time we got down in Imperial Valley and the San Jacinto Valley was basically during 2007. We had some interest from folks, so we wanted to go down there and look at the wildlife areas to see what we could do to help improve their management capabilities. And then pretty much that started our working relationship with the wildlife areas and some of the private properties that are down there, working through various federal grant opportunities, as well as looking at the state for opportunities to fund projects. So back in 2007 is when we started, and it was kind of a slow burn. We got several large NACA grants, which were roughly about $1 million each, both for the Imperial Valley as well as the San Jacinto area, separate grants, but kind of got us going down there. And then there was about 4 or 5 years where we were pretty active, and then things slowed down, federal funding slowed down, became more difficult to get federal funds down there. And then pretty much once we got into, 2017, 2018, we were able to secure additional funding through the state to go about continuing efforts on Imperial Valley. And not so much on San Jacinto. We did a large project there from 2007 to 2009. Kind of did a lot of stuff that helped improve their capabilities at San Jacinto wildlife area, and then concentrated more on Imperial, where we had larger acreage, a lot more opportunities to do work, and we had the state willing to fund some projects down there. And then really have gotten ramped up over the last 5 or 6 years at Imperial, where state funding has come through big. And then just most recently, we submitted some federal requests for North American Wetland Conservation Act funding for Imperial, as well as closer to the Colorado River. So I would say probably the largest, between 2007 and 2021, we were able to secure and implement about $11 million worth of projects on the ground.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's a pretty big number. And then pretty much since about 2002, we've secured $18.9 million since 2022. And that money is going to probably take us through about 2028 or 29 construction-wise. So we did quite a bit for, let's see, that was roughly about a 13-year period. And then within the last 5 years, we've secured almost twice that amount.
Wow, so that's impressive. For somebody who's not from there, such as myself, where in relation so be it, major cities, is the difference between San Jacinto and then the Imperial areas?
So, I mean, as far as location goes, the San Jacinto Wildlife Area is located right around Lake Paris, Temecula area, Hemet, right in that area. There's a magnificent valley in there. Mystic Lake is located there. It's an ephemeral lake that's quite large. It'll remain flooded for about 4 to 5 years, and then it'll dry up and waits for the next big rains to come off of this San Jacinto mountain range and reflood it. And the San Jacinto Wildlife Area sits right adjacent to that lake, which they actually own. And it's a huge pull for birds in Southern California. Birds, as they migrate through, they're pretty much going along the coastline. After they leave the Central Valley, they either hit the coast, they hit the San Jacinto Valley, or they may go through the Tehachapis and up and over into kind of the eastern side of the mountain range and run through, it's Owens Lake area, or all the way down towards Imperial Valley. And then, so if you look at inland wetland concentrations in Southern California, you have San Jacinto Valley, you'd have Imperial Valley, and then you also have the Colorado River, which is also a big pull where we've been doing quite a bit of work the last couple of years.
Okay, gotcha. That makes more sense. And then San Jacinto's made up of separate units, because that's where Worcester lies, right?
Well, the San Jacinto Valley is the Lake Paris Hemet area, which is, you're talking an hour and 15, 20 minutes east of Los Angeles.
Okay. Yeah.
Right by, say, if you ever heard of Big Bear,
yeah,
or
yep.
Lake Paris, big fishing mm-hmm. area, Diamond Reservoir, big bass fishing area. Also, pretty large water, it's the largest concentration of freshwater wetlands inland from the coast. In that whole Southern California region. Then if you go over the San Jacinto Mountains, like through Beaumont, if you're going to Palm Springs, then you have Salton Sea. And then the Salton Sea is sitting south of Palm Springs area. And around the sea, towards Mecca, which would be like the northwestern kind of corner of Salton Sea, there's some duck clubs up there.
Yeah.
On the north end and northwest side, very close to Palm Springs. And then as you go southwards, the majority of the private duck clubs are going to be along the southern edge of the Salton Sea and up the east side of the Salton Sea. And then Imperial Wildlife Area and Sunny Bono National Wildlife Refuge are both fairly close proximity to each other, but they're on the southeast kind of corner of the Salton Sea area.
Gotcha.
And then if you go about an hour and a half east of that, you'll hit the Colorado River, and over there you have Palo Verde Ecological Reserve, and then you also have Cibola National Wildlife Refuge. Cibola National Wildlife Refuge is both in California and Arizona.
Oh, really?
The majority of the managed wetlands and green feed units that Cibola has are on the Arizona side, but to get to them, you have to come through California to get to that refuge.
Wow, there's no that's strange.
From,
I never
no
knew that.
Access from the Arizona side. So a lot of the hunters that hunt at Cibola are coming. They have to come through California to get to that refuge.
Huh.
So we're hoping to have some good things take place at Cibola over the next couple of years as well. We just put them in our current NACA proposal, which was shipped off to the feds last week. So that'll be kind of an expansion for us to do some additional work on another refuge just outside of California.
Perfect. Well, that gives me a little bit better idea of the area and how stuff lays out. I'll kind of open the floor to you if you want to touch on certain projects that we've had recently or in the past in specific units that, the hunter, everyday hunter down there that's used to the refuges would know, whether it's a certain unit or, north end of whatever area, and projects that we've done to enhance habitat. I even saw something about where we did dove fields there, some at one of the units in the past year. And I saw a picture of those. Those were looking good. So what are some of the areas specifically within those units that we've been doing, and why have we been doing it?
Working when we first did some projects at San Jacinto, the manager at San Jacinto Wildlife Area, also a supervisor for Imperial. So we knew that they had some needs out in Imperial. I'll talk a little bit about San Jacinto, I guess, first, because it's kind of the one we haven't done a whole lot over the last few years, little projects here and there. San Jacinto was a location where we had a lot of interest because there was four duck clubs that surrounded it, and a lot of people use it. So back in 2007, the request came that they'd like us to come down and look at their habitat quality and see what we could do to improve things. So when we got down there, it was pretty obvious, you know, there was a lot of opportunities to improve management capabilities for staff down there. That way they could have better feed production, hold birds. You know, the biggest thing we heard, whether it was Imperial Valley or San Jacinto Valley, from both landowners and managers of the refuge and wildlife areas, was that, you know, they had pulses of birds that would come in, hang out for a couple of days, and then they'd go, you know, they'd head south or they'd move on to some other areas. The ability to hold birds wasn't really there because the resources that were there to feed these migrants was not very high. Very little was capabilities. None of the capabilities were really built in that allowed them to do good management to produce a lot of resources for migratory birds. Most of these areas were built back in the late 60s, early 70s. Wetland management wasn't a priority. It was more of a flood these up, let the birds have at them, and then walk away after duck season. And, you know, kind of just like it was up in the North Valley, in Sacramento Valley, Central Valley, where management wasn't really a key component of designing wetlands back then. It was more make an impoundment, hold water. That way we could hunt it and walk away after duck season. Well, you know, given time and research and the results from various research projects and people figuring out, you know, there's ways to manipulate management capabilities where you can produce a ton of resources for migratory birds, which is basically give them a bunch of groceries and they're going to hang out a whole lot longer than if there's nothing for them to eat there. You know, it's kind of intuitive for people. You know, if you're hungry, you got a grocery store next door full of food, you're going to hang out there compared to at your buddy's house where there's nothing. The research really allowed us to figure out, you know, what's the best way to design wetlands so you could have the capabilities for management staff to put water on, take it off, and produce a lot of resources. So going in and looking at existing infrastructure, it was very obvious what things needed to be done. You know, there wasn't a lot of people, you know, in 2007 doing work in Southern California like we were doing in the Central Valley. So you get down there, see the opportunities, write the proposals, get the funding, and then start to create the capabilities for the staffs where they could do a lot of good management, which then basically over time you saw, you know, within the first 3 to 5 years, managers taking advantage of those improvements that we implemented and seeing the results from one for harvest was going up and two, birds were staying a lot longer on these public areas. And the same results were happening for the private landowners that we worked with, where you saw, you know, they were having, you convince them to do certain management practices, they start to produce more resources. And the area in general starts to have a lot more opportunities for the hunter because everybody's starting to manage in a way that's producing a lot more of what these waterfowl want while they're in the area. So that was, you know, both we were educating people on what they should be doing because not a lot of people knew what they were supposed to be doing. And then two, you know, giving them the infrastructure that would allow them to do it. So then everything's kind of compounding, better bird use, birds staying longer, greater opportunities for, you know, guys while they're in the blind to see birds.
Yeah, definitely. So what are some of the improvements that you talk about? Because you talk about improvements and some people might not understand, like, are we building new roads? Are we water infrastructure? What are we actually doing on the ground that is attracting these birds more than, obviously, like you said, way back in the day, just flood up, flood down, walk away?
Well, so at Imperial, what we're doing out in Imperial is they were kind of set up like terraced rice fields, fairly small units. You know, the majority of the time out in Imperial has different issues that they're dealing with, say, as opposed to San Jacinto, as opposed to like Palo Verde or the Colorado River area folks. San Jacinto receives its water from the Colorado River. Imperial Irrigation District delivers all their water via surface canals. And then once water gets onto the wildlife area, one of their biggest issues historically is that they're delivering water through open ditches. And these open ditches, staff has to run water into each unit through these open ditches. Now, the open ditches, since we have basically a 12-month growing period down there, become pretty much impassable waterways as soon as the salt cedar and the phragmites grows. They can clean out a ditch, and within 18 months, it's pretty much solid vegetation again.
Oh, wow.
So, and that just reduces flows. It takes longer to flood things up. Things become less efficient. And as they're purchasing this water, you know, they either take it right then or it keeps going down the line and out to the sea. So when you have impenetrable ditches, but they've ordered the water, say water then goes down out to the sea as opposed to going into the wildlife area in a lot of cases. So early on, we started with making scraper wide high line delivery ditches with broad slopes so that they could manage the vegetation within the ditches with their mowers. If they had to, they could bring in a scraper and clean them out. Most of the time they could maintain things with mowers when the mowers were working. That's the way we started off, like 2007, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, basic water delivery ditches.
Basic water delivery ditches, as opposed to an excavated delivery ditch down there, because they didn't own the staff there didn't have an excavator to clean out these ditches. So they'd have to basically save up their own M money. And then once they had enough, they could start cleaning out what ditches they could until the money was gone. And then they were left with some ditches cleaned out, some not. So it was always a problem for them. So creating these other opportunities was highlighting ditches at the equipment that usually was working and they had the capabilities to mow. They could drop them right into the ditches and mow them. And then given time, it became obvious that even that was somewhat difficult for them, depending upon staffing, depending upon the mowers, the condition the mowers were in. Because just up until about recently, they really started getting, you know, within the last 5 years, DFW has done a great job at getting equipment to Imperial, to San Jacinto, to all their wildlife areas, putting a bigger emphasis on giving them the equipment that they need to operate these areas. You know, prior to that, a lot of the, you know, Imperial was the equipment quality, most of it was extremely old, whether it functioned or not, that was always questionable. Yeah. So looking at the, you know, what staff had to deal with, you know, eventually by about 2012, 13, 14 became obvious, like, let's try pipelines. Pipelines typically are going to cost 3 or 4 times as much to put in as opposed to an open ditch. But you're, you know, pretty much once you put in a pipeline, the thing's going to outlast my kids and it has almost no maintenance.
Yeah.
So you cut down on and you have no evaporation loss. You have no ditch loss. So it really kind of became the way to go for Imperial as far as benefits go. Easy to operate. You can go unit by, you know, they can deliver water to each unit independently. You know, open up a valve, discharge the water, it goes right into it. So pretty much from about 2013 to 14, we just started doing straight pipeline systems for Imperial. And we're still working on those today. I mean, that place has miles and miles of ditches and putting in miles and miles of pipeline.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, a lot of the times, you know, majority, I'd say, of most of the construction down there is you had extremely small units. You could shoot right across them, you know, from one levee to the other levee. Yeah, I mean, they're tight. So you could, and there's no real reason, you know, most of it was set up, just like I said, terraced rice fields that are extremely tight, you know, and you could shoot right across. So most of the guys got, most of the people that hunted Imperial are pretty used to sitting on one levee and shooting either side of that levee.
That's like, so foreign no to islands. Anybody that hunts the valley.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it just depends on where you grew up and where
100%.
What you hunted. So they, you know, you get used to where you're hunting and how it always has been. So one of the big things we've done, because maintenance is such an issue down there with salt cedar and phragmites, where every levee is basically a growing spot for these invasive plants. They suck up a ton of water. They're hard to control once they get started, and they grow all year, like I said. So the less infrastructure that Department of Fish and Wildlife has to maintain, obviously things, they have other time to do other things. So a lot of times what we're doing down there, the elevations will allow us to combine three existing units into one larger unit, do some leveling. But what it does is basically you get rid of two levees and you take four levees basically and you reduce it down to two.
Yeah.
So you cut that maintenance down by half on a new unit.
Throwing up islands in those units too, or?
Oh yes. Yep. Gotcha. You're putting in islands, you're doing all new levees, broad slopes. What you've also done when you reduce that infrastructure is you reduce the number of drains. So you might go from three or four drains down to one drain. So you're reducing the amount of time it takes a staff to operate boards. And then by flattening it all out, you're reducing a lot of the times, you're making a larger unit. So it takes a little bit longer to flood up, but at the same time, you've reduced the amount of water's edge that's going to be growing salt cedar and phragmites that they have to deal with on a regular basis. And then you're down to one structure, say, instead of three structures. So you've reduced that as well. So it's kind of like, and then you're adding in swale systems, which are driving water from the inlets to the outlets, moves water quickly, unit to unit. Now you have fairly decent drop from unit to unit. So they're able to irrigate fairly rapidly with a larger unit. And by the swales allowing water to move quicker, you're going irrigate the top unit and you can irrigate all the way down the line each unit sequentially fairly rapidly and get great results out of it. So we're making it easier for the managers to do a better job at managing so they get better results.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff at Imperial, the older stuff, I mean, you have water control structures that have failed, that have been abandoned, that barely hold water, don't hold much water. So you get the conditions down there with the salt that comes in on the soil or in the water column. The salts are pretty hard on concrete. It's pretty surprising. You have a lot of salt buildup where you don't have, where water's evaporating off, you get a lot of salt buildup. So there's some of those fields we've gone and started, gone to rehab and looks like a little Morton salt factory. And then you make it where they can drain the water off of it or get water to it more efficiently. And then within about 3 to 5 years, you start to have timothy production that's fairly good. Yeah. And you have these areas that were devoid of plants starting to grow great resources for waterfowl.
Well, I think that's one of the hard things for the average public land hunter to grasp is that when us or some other organization comes in and starts doing these improvement projects, it may not look, great the first year or the second year, but most of the time with wetlands work, you're not playing a next year or the year after game. You're playing a long-term game. And so we hear the complaints from people. It's like, oh, they moonscaped my unit. It's like, well, yes, but wait for 3 years from now and you're going to be thanking me just because it looks bad doesn't mean it's going to be bad.
Yeah, and we have done a much larger effort over the last 3 to 4 years of putting up signs at Imperial, at the check station, identifying, we have a host of PR options that we take advantage of. One, the magazine, the fall issue, tells everybody where we did work that summer. And with most all the biologists are going to give a little update on the work that we did, say 2024, what it looks like this year for 2025-26. At the same time, we put in there, hey, we did a bunch of work in 2025 summer. Here's the units we did it in, so be aware of that. Mm-hmm. Now, at Imperial, we go a little bit farther. I'd also say that we have maps up at the check station. I do them for the Sacramento Valley, any refuge or state wildlife area we do work on, and all the Imperial and the San Jacinto. We'll have a map up there that says what year we did the work, and then what was affected this last summer. So people have, if they get there early and they check out the maps, it'll say on there where we did work 2025, so they have an idea. At the same time, we've put up a lot of posters at Imperial telling people, hey, here's what we're going to be working on in 2026, FYI, and we're going to start drawing those units down in January so people know ahead of time. It's not a surprise because Imperial takes so... The units are in such bad shape when we go to do work on them. It may take 3 months to dry them out. I mean, we may pull the water off January 1st or try to, And we can't get equipment into them until, say, late April. Gotcha. And then once they're dry enough to get equipment into them, we still sometimes have to survey them, design them, and get them ready for construction. So at Imperial, we put up a lot of signage saying, here's where we work this summer, here's where we're working next summer. And at the same time, we try to tell everybody about that information in the magazine as well in the fall issue. But we, like you said, people, a lot of people just show up the day they got drawn. They go out to the field they've always gone to. Mm-hmm. And then they walk out there and it's been moonscaped at Imperial. And those are usually people I hear from. Yeah. And I try to explain to, you know, like you said, we're, as a biologist doing, you know, the last time somebody built this, you know, touched this field with a scraper was, you know, or a dozer was probably 1972. Well, you know, it's 2025 and our main goal is to make it where, you know, in your lifetime, you're not going to have to see another scraper come in here. You're going to get to hunt it from here on out. It's going to have incredible feed production compared to what it had before. So, you know, we ask, you know, that's kind of why we're trying to tell people what's going on, when it's going on. And then that way we hope they have some patience and grace with us. And then there's also, you know, there's some people you'll never make happy, but it's funny. I've gotten so much hate mail from folks, you know, the first year and then the next year they might, it's still not that great. And then by about year three, I never hear from them. Yeah. And they're not really telling people where they're hunting either. But
yeah,
you know, I always take that as a positive where it's like, well, they were really complaining about it early on and now they're pretty quiet. And oh, by the way, you know, bird averages have gone up on that wildlife area or in that area. Or
yeah.
Probably one of the neater projects I had it in out at Imperial is when we redid the 413s. Used to be a massive fish farm from back in the late 60s, early 70s, where they grew fish for the Salton Sea. And it was just an eyesore, buildings, abandoned buildings. And we completely reconstructed that place back in, it was a duck stamp project and a WCB project. I think it was like 2012. And by the second year, it was one of the most popular areas on the wildlife area for the hunters to want to go to. It was one of the early picks because it was the second year of production. They were doing great management on it. And it was like within 2 years, it was one of the top areas for harvesting birds. So
as someone that's been in this profession, wildlife wetlands management, for as long as you have, what is that good age for a redone wetland to be like, hey, this year it should be there? I mean, I know there's different variables with water, but say, you know, perfect conditions, the managers can put water on and water off. Down in Southern California specifically, how long is that? 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah, I would say most of the time it's going to depend on how they're managing it, but it's probably like that year 4 to 6,
okay,
somewhere in there. I mean, you should be getting at a really good spot then.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it's lots of variables, but I would say that 4 to year 6 is going to be pretty awesome. And then after that, it comes down to how often are they discing, how often mm-hmm. are they setting.
Yeah, at that point, it's out of our hands and into the management hands.
Correct.
Our fall hunt program is open, so go to calwaterfowl.org to apply today. This is dove, deer, turkey, waterfowl, pheasants, and more at calwaterfowl.org through our hunt program. We have first come, first serve opportunities still for our women's only hunts and our duck camp. Duck camp is a 2.5-day event for anyone. Learn all about duck hunting, waterfowl ID, calling, and go on 2 different hunts. Food lodging is included. Remember, August 16th is our deadline for all dove hunts and one of our big game hunts. So apply today. We have some upcoming events. So we have something that is new. We're having a contest for the longest pintail feather. Find more information on our website. Upcoming events, we have the Chino Banquet, July 31st. We have the Santa Margarita Banquet, August 2nd. And then we have our bingo event on August 21st. Go to calwaterfowl.org for more information.
Did we do something, talk about, you know, kind of instant gratification with a dove field is a little bit different, being able to turn the soil, plant the crop and flood it or irrigate it. Did we do something down there this year with doves?
Yeah, pretty much each of the bigger projects we've been doing at Imperial will have some green feed units in it. So they'll grow green feed for geese. They'll also do their upland units for their dove hunting. Sometimes they'll do Milo and they'll do put and take pheasants out of it.
Oh, so nice.
Most each, you know, when we take on, say, like a 513 or a 312 unit down there, the green feed or the upland area is also going to be included. So we've been, most of those fields hadn't been leveled. Most of the time when we get into the green feed or the upland fields, they haven't been leveled in, it could be a decade or more. So most of that is having the pipelines installed, new valving, which is making it super efficient for them. And then the leveling is creating a situation where we're pretty much, their level east to west falling to either the south or north. So they're getting really good irrigations on the fields themselves compared to, you know, sometimes they've been dealing with it where it's slightly slanted to one direction or the other, or there's holes that have over time developed. So most of the leveling stuff we're doing is, one, we're not necessarily looking at what's existing when we get there. It's like, how can we set up the ideal irrigatable unit for staff? And sometimes it's like they want a 10 acre, they want a 20 acre. And depending upon the topography out there, we'll kind of cater to their needs, but at the same time, maximize their plantable acreage.
Yeah.
And we're also putting in some, you know, drainage swales that they can plant, easily irrigate, so they get more mesquite trees going or Palo Verde trees going. So there's some upland stuff that's also good in roosting spots for dove that are being installed at Imperial. San Jacinto, we've got plans. San Jacinto was one where we started and did a huge project there initially. Over a three-year period, we went into every existing wetland unit, redid their swales, did some leveling. Built, you know, the walker units, if anybody hunts the walker units used to be very, very small. And we like blew that place up, made it five times what it historically was prior to us being there. And put in a water return system for the wildlife area where all the water comes down to one location and is then picked up and then reused for management on the walker units. And also can supply their riparian corridor that they have there. Well, you know, that was, we did that, gosh, you know, 15 years ago, I did that project. And since then, you know, water's gotten more expensive. So we just received funding from the Wildlife Conservation Board to go in and kind of upgrade the whole water return system, where we're going to be able to take all the water that's used on the wildlife area, which they purchase at a very high price, and then pump it to the very top of the wildlife area and then store that water and several semi-permanent wetland units that are going to be built as part of the project and give them storage capacity. So they'll be able to, we're hoping they'll be able to recapture 700 to 1,000 acre feet of water, store that, and then use it throughout the spring to do all their irrigations and supply all their brood ponds. And then all the wetland units are going to get tuned up. We're going to expand, create, hopefully these semi-permanent units are going to also function as a kind of a sanctuary area, most likely, because they're kind of going to be variable as far as water, how much water they have and what they're using. But San Jacinto, if Mystic Lake is not flooded, then the wildlife here itself doesn't have a resting spot for the birds. So a lot of times hunt days, Mystic Lake's not there. All the clubs, all the wildlife here are being shot. I mean, the birds will boogie. They're going to go somewhere, go sit up on some of the lakes around in the area, and then maybe eventually come back. But we know how, you know, birds get shot off an area.
They're going to go find somewhere.
They got to go a long way. Exactly. They may find something else they like better and not go back. So
yeah,
we might be building in some dependable areas where birds can sit. So they'll be a lot closer to the hunters when Mystic Lake's not flooded.
All right,
at the same time, San Jacinto is going to have expansion of its seasonal wetland acreage as part of this project that was funded by the Wildlife Conservation Board. The return water capabilities to recapture all the water that they're going to use in any given year. And then their upland component for dove hunting, for pheasants, is going to be expanded quite a bit. We're going to be able to give them roughly about 140 acres of irrigated acreage, which is significantly more than what they currently have. So lots of good expansion at San Jacinto will be coming up in the next 2 to 3 years. Imperial, we're still continuing with. Last summer, we did the 312 units. This summer, we've completely reconstructed the 513s. And the 115s are being completely reconstructed right now. All new pipelines, water control structures, levees. Irrigations have been taking place on the 513 units. So there's lots of emergent cover growth. And then 114 units will go next summer. And then everything that we did over the last 2 years, which would be the Y15s, W11, W12s, have had extensive irrigations completed on them. Really, the Y15 and the W11s look really good. W12's coming along. They've done a lot. They've probably done 4 irrigations on it, trying to get some emergent cover up. So it looks a little better than last year. That is an area that kind of had feed production is coming along. It's on its second year. We built it last year. So it's on its first year of management, getting good results. Next summer will be a lot better for it. You know, another year down there, that area had a really high salt content due to evaporation issues. So we're leaching out a lot of the salts and it's becoming more viable, but it's going to take another year or two before W12 really starts to look great. Although the eastern units in that whole complex look good for this coming fall. And then, you know, a whole different area that people probably haven't been over to is Palo Verde Ecological Reserve over by Blythe. That is a property that was purchased by the Wildlife Conservation Board back in 2004, 2005 or 2006, somewhere in there. And the department kept about 500 acres of it for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to manage for public hunting. The capabilities out there was historically a farm. A lot of it was defunct. Projects that were done early on created a 60-acre wetland complex. And there was about 125 to 145 acres that was manageable for food plots. So they would grow everything from alfalfa to safflower to a lot of winter wheat for dove hunting. If you've ever wanted to go and think you're in Argentina dove hunting, Palo Verde would be a place I would visit because it's pretty much very comparable to like something in South America. It's ridiculous. As long as it's, you know, a summer storm doesn't come through, but
blow them out.
I've hunted it. It is absolutely stupid. But what we were able to do there is they had about 350 acres of the area. About 300 acres was not manageable by the department for anything. Everything was delivered through concrete lined ditches that were built on sand, given time and rodents and squirrels and just time, you know, earthquakes and what have you. That 300 acres, they couldn't deliver water to in any way, shape or form. So the project that the Wildlife Conservation Board funded back last year, we did this last year, was we went into the 60 acres of wetlands, kind of rehabbed them, tuned them up, gave them a little better water delivery. And then pretty much all the farmable ground, which is about 440 acres, got all new pipelines. Everything was leveled. We created some irrigation swales at the bottom of all the upland units so that they could plant what we ended up purchasing, a ton of mesquite and Palo Verde trees. They've got those planted. And then, you know, everything from fertilizer to winter wheat. So the entire complex is manageable as far as for growing crops now. And so that was one where you had a little bit of opportunity, but now there's a whole complex. All 500 acres is in production.
That's pretty cool. Taking something that small, well, was big, but like you said, the opportunity wasn't big, and now turning it back into what it could be. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and that's a unique spot where they had a little bit of wetlands, but there's also, you know, geese use it. It's a big crane spot, so the cranes use it. So from a waterfowl standpoint, you know, we looked at it as, well, we can create a lot of great habitat. You know, the upland habitat is not only going to benefit all the quail. There's a little bit of pheasant out there, but there's a ton of quail, ton of dove. The cranes use it to stop over. They will get a, you know, the geese will swing by and hit the upland areas that are available, because they'll just mow the wheat down. Mm-hmm. So the crane, easy access for the cranes and the geese. When they sit there in the winter and they irrigate those upland areas, the ducks will get into them pretty heavily. It's pretty surprising. They come right off the Colorado River, off the wetland units in there, and feed in these, in the all the little rows that are full of water and full of seed. It's pretty funny. And then, you know, there's some things people don't know, like that spot has a massive amount of mule deer.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Desert mule deer down
there. Colorado River. Desert mule deer, and there is a lot of them.
That's pretty
probably one of the better kept secrets as far as that goes. And I think, yeah, you can only bow hunt down there. Otherwise, the bird hunting is phenomenal. Between the dove and the quail and the ducks, pretty neat.
Yeah, lots of opportunity down there. I know you're talking about being able to grow duck food in a wetland. Is the main one that you get down there timothy? Is that what you're aiming for, or do you get water grass pretty much at all?
I mean, that's the easiest. They'll do Japanese millet. You know, we're always trying to get them to do timothy because it's pretty cheap and free as long as they get their irrigations down. And then they water grass will do fine down there. They just got to get it in early. The Japanese millet, they can plant a little bit later. It seems like so far from what I've seen from the water grass is the really hot temperatures. They just have to get on the water grass earlier. They can do it in March, seed it in March and give it a couple of irrigations, it'll do fine.
Yeah.
And timothy, if they can do, they can draw down in early, you know, mid-February. As soon as duck season's over, pretty much down there, you can kind of draw down, germinate your timothy, get it two or three or four irrigations, and you can get a pretty good carpet pretty quick. It just depends on what other things are going on the wildlife area and what the, you know, what their priorities are. But yeah, timothy would be especially with the salt content that can be pretty high in some of these units that we're just getting to. We'll sit there and, you know, it may take 2 years before you really start to see timothy germinating and growing, especially in the units that are closer to the sea.
Yeah, I think, you know, the duck hunter, any duck hunter should educate themselves on actual waterfowl food, because being in this profession for the last 8 years now, it's so surprising to me how many people look at, say, a field of water grass and we get the complaint, oh, there's too many weeds. It's like, you're literally looking at a field full of duck food, or, you know, somebody looks under the water, they're gonna have no clue what timothy looks like. But if you educate yourself on that and you go out, you might find that unit that people are overlooking because they don't know what that stuff actually looks like. You just go off of what you know has shot ducks before. But if you know what to look for, it can help out a lot.
Yep, that's for sure. I mean, that's, you know, a lot of what CWA biologists do is, you know, we do a ton of educating, whether it's state and federal folks or it's private landowners. That's our main emphasis, is going out there and educating people on how to be better managers of their habitat, so they can produce more resources and hopefully have more success. You know, we always tell people, hey, I can guarantee I can bring you more birds if you do the right things. I can't guarantee how you shoot. I've had that where, you know, I've talked to landowners and they want to shoot more birds and they want to do the right thing. And you're like, all right, well, you gotta, you know, I can tell nobody's dissed this ground for probably 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's full of garbage. And so first thing you guys got to do is you got to do a bunch of disking. Oh, no, we don't disc here. I said, I know that you don't. I can tell.
Yeah, we don't want to walk through this field. It's like, too bad.
Right. And so, you know, that's something I've had conversations with people like, no, you need to disc if you want to get food that it's going to attract more birds. And you can usually end a conversation right there. It's like, well, we don't disc here. All right. You probably, yeah. Good luck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But at the same time, you try to talk to people and it's like, well, listen, you don't have to disc the whole unit. You're on a 4-year rotation. So you're doing, you know, if you just 20% of your acreage every single year and you're not hitting an entire unit, you're just doing a quarter of it or 20% of it, you'll be on that 4-year rotation. It becomes really obvious where you dissed last year and where you dissed 3 years ago and where you haven't dissed for 5 years. I mean, the plant community, once you know the three plants, you're going to know exactly, okay, that's garbage, even if you don't know what the plants are, but I know it's not timothy or smartweed or water grass.
Yep.
So, you know, that's one of the the teaching tools we have is meeting people, looking at their property, you know, and giving them our opinion as to what, how they can improve the management. That's going to hopefully give them better habitat, and then they'll be able to have better success in the future.
Yeah, we could, just talking about it now, we could definitely do another episode at some point just on basics of management. And you know, I have a lot of folks that come to me and they're like, well, how do you get in contact with CWA? What is, who puts up the money? All these questions that we should probably do an episode and get you on here and maybe one of the other wetlands biologists and talk about, you know, hey, private property landowners and why we do stuff with them as well as the public stuff and how folks can go about managing their wetlands better. But that's for another time. Do you have anything else you want to touch on about some of the Southern California stuff you're doing before we sign out?
Yeah, probably one good point you did bring up right there is, you know, people question, you know, how, you know, you're always working with private landowners and you're not putting a lot of money on the state ground or on public ground. And in any given year, you know, with CWA, if you look at, you know, we do have our annual report that comes out and it tells you exactly where we're putting your money, you know, or where we're putting our grant money. So if you look at it in any given year, it's usually just over 70% of the acquired funds that we receive from grants that are doing habitat improvements is going on public ground. You know, the public ground is, you know, there's typically a lot more available for us to do bigger projects on. One, and private landowners, almost 99% of the time are contributing a portion of the construction or all of the cost of the construction, because private landowners will hire CWA to go in and do engineering, design, construction management for them because they want the project done right. And they just fund the whole thing themselves. And other options for us is to provide some type of funding as long as the landowner is willing to contribute to that. But in any given year, CWA, you know, if we're looking at $12 million worth of construction this summer, you can just over 70, 73% of that's going on public ground to improve stuff. I mean, this summer alone, just at Imperial, I'm doing close to $2 million of improvements on Imperial Wildlife Area between the 115 and the 513 projects. So, you know, California, you know, a lot of times we have, you know, Southern California took us a while to get going just based upon staffing. But once we got in there, I mean, like I said, over the last 4 years, you know, from 2022 to 25, we've received $19 million in grants, which is going to last us for like another three and a half years worth of work down there. And that's just what we received. We just submitted a $3 million proposal last week for Southern California to do work on Cibola and Imperial and San Jacinto and Sunny Bono National Wildlife Refuge, which we've done quite a bit of work on Sunny Bono. So if you had to look at the state as a whole, Southern California right now is getting the majority, you know, is taking a lion's share of funding that's being implemented. You know, like this year, we got about just at Imperial's $2 million. If you look at Southern California in general, it's probably going to be closer to $3 million worth of work on a year where we got about $12 million worth of contracts. So there's a significant portion of our construction. And if you look at California as a whole, Central Valley, Sacramento Valley, Grasslands, Tulare, Northeastern California, we've got a ton of stuff going on. Yolo Bypass and Sassoon, as well as the Delta. So Southern California is getting a big, big push as far as project implementation by us.
Yeah, as it should.
Oh, and you know, another thing too, one more thing.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, you know, if you're hunting San Jacinto or you're hunting Imperial, look me up on the website. I am more than willing. Call me. A lot of times people have misconceptions or they have rumors or they hear rumors, which is 9 times out of 10. Somebody's super upset and it's because their buddy told them something that was completely off the wall. So I encourage any duck hunter out there who has a question about a project in Southern California, just pick up the phone and call me. And I'm glad to answer your questions. I'm glad to give you a heads up on where we're doing work and why we're doing it. So, and there's been a lot of input from the public down there. So, you know, Imperial's getting gravel walkways to their blinds, their new blind areas. They're getting a ton of gravel on roads and parking lots, but you know, we didn't put any gravel in for walkways to blinds. And then we started doing it, and then they wanted them a little bit wider. Now people are like, this is the way to go. So
yeah,
we do make modifications based upon suggestions from the public. So
no, that's perfect. Yeah. If anybody ever wants to get a hold of anybody at CWA, calwaterfowl.org is our website. You can find all of our employees. The phone numbers are attached. So if you're down in Southern California, you have a question about something that you're seeing, please feel free to reach out to Chad. Or if you have a question about any of the work in the region that you hunt, look up our biologists and reach out to them. They'd be happy to talk to you. But Chad, I appreciate you coming on today, talking about Southern California. Hopefully we'll get you back on sometime soon. Just talk about general wetlands management.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks, Carson, for the opportunity.
All right. Have a good rest of your day.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. So we're going to end this segment with our Southern California field rep, Chad Thomas. We're going to talk about how people can get involved, what events we have down there, and what his job is in Southern California. Chad, thanks for joining us. I'm happy to have you on. Yeah. What do you got going down in SoCal for everyone?
Yeah. Happy to be on. So for those that I haven't met, I'm the Southern California field rep, although I cover a pretty substantial area of the state, but I do a lot of the work down south of the Grapevine in San Diego, Orange County, LA County, even out into the desert. So coming up on our calendar, we have July 31st. We got our Chino banquet over at Central Bosco. That's a small kind of event, tables only, but real fun time, good time had by all. On August 2nd, we got our Santa Margarita banquet. That's going to be over the Vista Elks Lodge. This is a real vets-oriented, veteran and active military. It's ran by an all-vet committee, really centers around kind of the active military camaraderie, and but still open to everybody and still an awesome event to attend. And then we're actually looking at starting a new banquet in the Riverside area. So on September 24th, we're going to have kind of a little party get-together recruitment meeting over at Thompson Brewing Company. So I mean, if you want to come out, if you want to be in, you know, a part of a team with CWA, I'm happy to cover some beers and pizza, and we're going to have a good time and talk about potentially getting something on the calendar down in that area. And then we'll do the same thing in Paso Robles come November on the 4th over at my buddy's shop, Sheep's Head Outfitters. So we're going to have a lot of wine over there, as it's the Paso Robles thing to do instead of beer, but we'll have some good eats, some good times, and we'll talk about kind of a game plan moving forward.
And where do people find this information? Just all on our website?
Yeah, yeah. So if you go to CWA's website and you go to the events tab, you'll go ahead and see everything. You can register. It gives me a heads up and a potential head count. You can go ahead and grab your tickets there. And if you have any questions, my contact information is on the website as well. So you can just go to the about and the staff page and look me up. My cell phone number is plastered right there. Give me a call if you got any questions or shoot me a text. So outside of the area, we're going to be doing a bingo in Bishop. This is actually my first bingo. So we're going to do a bingo for some firearms, some cool prizes, raffle, everything over at the Elks Lodge in Bishop. And then I got a Bakersfield banquet on October 11th. And then I'll be in Mendota parking lot for the opening day, or the night before the opener, sweatlining it with everybody, but also doing a cool raffle out that way. Hopefully have some fun and give some cool prizes away.
Nice. And what else are you doing down there? I know you've been involved with some youth hunts, getting those going and helping promote those. What else are you doing in SoCal?
Yeah. So like touching on the youth hunts, one of the big projects that we've been trying to stay as active in is the Lake Barrett Hunt Program. And that's a project. The city of San Diego actually owns Lake Barrett and has a hunt program. So for a city to have an established hunt program for people to go out and pursue waterfowl is a rare gem, especially in Southern California. So I worked with some pretty active volunteers down there, George Sawaya and David Blackston, who are just absolute all-stars, working to advocate for this program and potentially expand it. And I was kind of proud last year. We actually, for the first year, got the Youth Weekend opened up for that hunt. And we actually got some mentors to come out there and take a bunch of kids. And they slayed it on the ducks, man. They had a great time. CWA and a bunch of other NGOs kind of fronted some money and bankrolled that event. And we're rolling that into 2025. And we're going to go beyond that and hopefully get a veterans hunt going as well. So if people want to go out and actually, you know, get in a boat and then go hunt the side banks of a lake, which is something, you know, as a Californian is kind of uncommon, and especially again in Southern California, very rare. That is on October 4th. You can go to San Vicente Reservoir. Got to be there at 7:30 in the morning. You sign up, you draw numbers for your spot in line, and then you get to actually pick your dates and put your name down and everything, so you'll know when you're able to hunt. And then they'll explain the whole program in detail there. But that is just an awesome program that we're really proud to be partnering with.
Yeah, that's interesting. So on that particular program, you show up, you draw. Is that like one date you get to pick, or is it multiple dates? How does that work?
So you get there at 7:30, everybody draws a poker chip, and that's your spot line. And then once your spot comes up, you go inside and they say, what dates do you want to hunt? And you say, I want to hunt this Saturday or this Wednesday in January or December or the opener, whatever dates are available and still have spots, then you pay them right there for your spot. So there's no, you know, 17 days before checking the reservation to see if you got a resi, and you know you're locked in for those dates. And then you go that morning of, you go down there, you check in at the boat dock, and you can rent a boat from them or you can provide your own, and you can go out and to your assigned blind and hunt. And then they have free roam too, which gets real fun because then you get to like bounce around the lake and chase ducks and whatnot. So that can be a lot of fun. So Lake Barrett, it's incredible. It's a really unique experience.
Yeah, I think the renting the boats part and then going out, I mean, I don't know any other place, you know, other than our own properties, but we don't necessarily rent the boats out. But any other like public access here in California that is ran like that, I think it's just so awesome to keep providing that opportunity.
And by a city.
Yeah, right?
And by a city. Every spot that you can pretty much duck on is just kind of, you know, owned by the Forest Service, owned by the State Fish and Wildlife Department. For the city to really do that, we're really proud of that program. We're hoping to expand it one day and bring it. Right now, we're just focused on bringing attention to it, making it popular, and that way we can grow upon that.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, let us know how we could help. I was looking into it over the wintertime a little bit, and the procedures and hunt results and all that stuff. It's pretty awesome. Pretty neat that people are getting it going. Anything else you're involved with down there that people should look up, or, you know, how could people stay a little bit more involved down there?
I'm involved in everything, dude. I got my hands in all the honeypots down here. So we also we're working with getting an advanced hunter education clinic. So I'm actually collaborating with Lieutenant Elliott from the department, who heads the advanced hunter education clinic. I love waterfowl hunting, but by trade, I'm a big game hunter, so I'm going to be a little selfish, and we're going to do a big game hunting clinic. So this is going to be teaching you everything from tracking, how to glass appropriate, how to read topographical mats, kind of just a 102, you know, everything after you get your hunter education certification. And then we're actually going to coordinate with the department and get a couple hogs. We'll go out and shoot them, you know, a day or two before. Thumb in the freezer, we'll bring them into the classroom so the students can actually get some hands-on experience and learn how to process an animal right there. And then I plan on doing that in Redondo Beach, which is just going to be awesome, and the neighbors are going to love us, but we have a good time and folks learn a lot there. So our partner organizations have done it in Compton. If they can do it in Compton, we can do it in Redondo. It's going to be fun.
Like when you guys do those events there, is it at like a shooting facility? I mean, what type of facilities are you using down in those areas where it's, you know, I believe, isn't there like a Compton rifle and shooting club or something like that, or hunting club?
Yeah, the Compton Hunting and Fishing Club. And it's one of the oldest clubs in the state. And, you know, surprisingly, there is a lot of opportunity to join those social clubs down there. There's a Long Beach Rod and Gun Club. There's a Redondo Rod and Gun Club. There's Compton. There's all kinds of different groups down there. It all kind of started like after World War II. Guys came back. They missed that camaraderie. They missed that time in the outdoors. So they started these social clubs around 1945, 46, just like CWA. So you know, these are really good people. If you're kind of new to hunting and you're looking for some mentorship, some camaraderie, this is the place to go. And so, yeah, we'll be doing it at the Rod and Gun Club down there. I'm still coordinating with them and getting all the logistics finalized. But we're going to execute that, and that's going to be a lot of fun. Those are always well-received. After I go out and, you know, get some more elk meat, bear meat in my freezer, I'm also going to plan on doing a cooking class somewhere down there. And that's always super popular. Folks want to come out and learn all the different recipes that cook with wild game. So, and I enjoy cooking, so it's a lot of fun for me selfishly.
We'll have to get you one of our events up here, man. We need some instructors.
I think there's some bluefin in the freezer for you guys.
Ooh,
so go snack now we're talking. Before somebody else does. So I got that going. I'm partnering with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We're going to execute a trivia night. We did a couple of these conservation trivia nights before the live broadcasting of Meat Eater 2 years ago, I think. And those were well attended. People had a lot of fun and we raffled off a lot of cool stuff. So I'm kind of working with my partner organization in there. And then with the same organization, we're also going to be represented at a Armed Forces Initiative deer hunt at Vandenberg Space Force Base.
Oh, nice.
I live right next door. So BHA is heading that up, but CWA is going to show up and assist on that. We're going to go out and cover food. It's camping out there and then do some mentorship and partnering with them. Try to get some active military and vets out and hopefully harvest some good deer. I've been out there on base a few times already, and the deer numbers are awesome this year. It's looking really good. It's going to be an awesome hunt. So if you're an active military or if you are a veteran, make sure you check out Backcountry Hunters and Anglers and sign up for that, and CW will be there as well. I think I'm cooking moose or something that weekend. That'd be fun.
Oh, nice. Moose is good. I'd rank that over elk and everything else.
Really? I got a 5-pound brisket that someone gave me, and I haven't cooked any of it yet, so I'm kind of saving it for a special weekend.
Yeah, let me know how what you think. I've had it a couple times. It's good.
Absolutely. And then we got some habitat days. We got a habitat day over at San Jacinto on August 16th. They're doing a cleanup out there. They do multiple of these every year. A group of diehard waterfowlers out there really put in the effort and always can use an extra helping hand to come out and brush up the blinds, clean up shells, do whatever needs to be done, because the refuge can always use an extra pair of helping hands to help out. And then they'll be doing the same thing over at Kern National Wildlife Refuge, August 9th. And they'll be installing a blind, our partners over at Tulare Basin Wetlands Association, every year fabricates a blind, sit-down blind, and or above-ground blind, and goes out there and installs it and brushes in and everything. And again, anybody willing to kind of meet some really great waterfowlers, tap into that local knowledge and, spend some time outside and helping out is always appreciated.
That's awesome, man. Well, appreciate everything that you're doing down there. If people want to get in touch with you, calwaterfowl.org, find all of our events and Chad's contact information. But keep doing what you're doing, Chad. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right. See you, bud.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.